coming on a Sunday, Saturday?
Saturday.
A weekend, let's say. Yeah. I'm really happy to be here with Daphna. We've known each other for a few years. Quite a long time, actually. I can't remember exactly how long, but all I know is that I've been following your work for a long time, and talking with you about your work is almost as enjoyable as viewing your work. So there's a really nice cohesion that comes along with you. And I had written a text a few years ago about your work, which we were just discussing earlier. I don't particularly enjoy writing. It's something that's quite challenging for me. And writing about Daphna's work was the easiest thing to do. It's the only time I've written an essay in one sitting. And I just remember thinking, wow, how did this happen so quickly? So that, I guess, was something that was a really nice starting point for our relationship. And I'm going to be writing something else in the near future, so that's really good. And this exhibition is a really nice way to kind of refresh this series. And I thought we should start by talking about the constructed landscapes and give people that may not be so familiar with your work an introduction into how this series started and how it's evolved over the past few years.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here in conversation with me, and thank you, Sid, as well, for the lovely introduction to all of you for being here on the last day of the show. It's been really nice to speak to people as they've come through the space. As I warned Shoaire, I'm sure a lot of you have heard me speak before or have read about my work, so this might be quite familiar, so apologies to those of you who know this inside and out. But we did think it was useful for people who might not know so much about how the work started. So I started the series originally in 2009, which I can't believe is now 10 years ago. And I kind of put it to one side for a few years and then really started to focus on it from 2012 onwards, alongside other projects that I've been working on and other things that I do. But I always kind of say that the work stemmed from what I felt initially was a frustration that I had photographing landscapes or photographing outside. So as soon as I stepped outside with my camera, I felt quite overwhelmed by the lack of limitations and just the kind of, not only physically, but also conceptually and historically in terms of the history of the genre of landscape, which I felt was incredibly loaded, and I felt that just taking straight images of landscapes was not something that I could do in an interesting way. And I always say, I make a little disclaimer at this point to say that it's not that I think straight images of landscapes are not interesting in themselves, it's just that mine failed miserably. And that's what kind of led me to start thinking more about making interventions in the negatives that I'd been shooting and that I'd accumulated over a number of years when I was just traveling back home and shooting very instinctively and compulsively, I would say, and without any real kind of conceptual aim or thought about what would happen with those images. So they were really just images I took out of a personal need to shoot and kind of, yeah, in retrospect, just found it really frustrating that I'd accumulated so much material that seemed to not do anything very interesting.
And then you started looking at the material you had and
what happened next?
Yeah, what happened next?
Well, I mean, I think it's also maybe important to point out that the start of the project also coincided with the fact that I'd just set up a shared color darkroom in East London with my friend Lucy Levine, who's also a really great photographer. We'd studied at the RCA together. And for many years, we were thinking of setting up a space where we could have access to a colour darkroom regularly, and finally managed to get around to doing it, and everything kind of fell into place in 2009. So we've been in the same studio in Space Studios since then. And so having access to a darkroom on a regular basis where I could just experiment and play around and do things without worrying too much about whether they would fail or not was really key in terms of the experimentation that led to making this work. Mm-hmm. And so initially what I started to do with these negatives that I'd accumulated was to take two negatives from different locations and combine them into this kind of hybrid space and cut out only one element from one layer of negative. So I was thinking of anything that was very obviously man-made that was somehow interrupting the so-called purity of the landscape and removing that from the negative. And then while I was printing, I realized that a really nice kind of happy accident came about, which was that where there was only one layer of negative, it went black. And I should have known, I should have foreseen that this would happen because I've been printing for a long time, but somehow it surprised me. And so I started to think a lot more about that void or that black space, which now kind of, you know, functions very differently in this work, but initially was more of like one element, which I felt the work was kind of the axis of the image, the kind of thing that the work revolved around in some way.
Mm-hmm. And so this idea of a constructed landscape, I've always had this kind of feeling that the possibilities must be infinite. You have this archive of negatives, and the way, the process in which you've developed to piece these things together means that there are so many possibilities.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how kind of limiting that is important, and how that's changed over time? Because you just spoke about, at the beginning, you were taking two negatives from two different locations and putting them together.
Yeah.
But the works in this show are something quite different from that, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of limitations, it's something we spoke about earlier and how important it is for me, and I think for a lot of artists, to impose a certain set of rules or limitations or parameters that you work within, because I think, as you say, otherwise it just becomes, there's like no limit to the amount of things that you can do, and it can be quite overwhelming. So that's why when I was talking about what I was removing from the negative, that became one of my kind of main rules, that you could say. So I didn't want it to be arbitrary what I was cutting out from the negative. I felt like there had to be a real reason for doing so. And so it seemed that the kind of man-made element seemed to be the obvious thing, because, well, for several reasons. One of them being that I felt that was the thing that, you know, in many cases led to people maybe kind of constructing a particular narrative or linking or anchoring those images to specific locations. And that was something I was hoping to resist or defy. So this kind of idea of specificity was something I was trying to kind of remove as much as possible. So, and also to resist a kind of particular narrative, and then also just what I found interesting as a paradox was I was removing these things that were man-made, but then I was replacing them with new interruptions that were also man-made. So this kind of manual, like the manual element, which I thought was interesting in contrast to the mechanical aspect of photography, mm-hmm. was something that I was quite interested in and became very conscious of. Mm-hmm. And I say this as if like this is all mapped out, you know, to begin with. It really wasn't. It was just something that I was kind of figuring out as I was going along. And I think that's the thing for me that has always been really important about the work, that, you know, it's because it's a process led, then as I'm working through and things happen in the dark room and there's so much back and forth between cutting and printing and, you know, this kind of like starting from quite a kind of blind kind of position, because I'm cutting from a negative with just like a small contact sheet as a reference, to then the printing where things start to kind of reveal themselves and then inform the kind of next step. So that the printing has always been an intrinsic part of the process and the project. And in answer to your question, what shifted or changed in terms of the process and conceptually as well is that from 2014 onwards, all of the images are made from multiple fragments of negatives shot on the same roll of film from the same location. So again, like I went from the rule of I have to combine two negatives that are completely different geographically to create this hybrid space. Now it's more about reconfiguring an existing location and abstracting it to a certain degree. And that becomes the kind of the kind of parameter that I work within.
Yeah. And this is, it's interesting because this is the one thing that constantly confuses me, actually, and catches me off guard. Because when I first started talking to you about your work many years ago, I got obsessed with this idea of you creating geographies that don't physically exist in real life, like the impossibility of this place ever existing. Although it looks like a landscape we might be familiar with or might have experienced before, there's no way you can ever physically go there. And so that's something that really stuck with me. But I think now being in this room, we have several different localities and geographies in the same space. There's lots of similarities between them, actually. And we do start to see things that are recognisable. So we have the Thames, we have Gibraltar, Cornwall and Norfolk. And do you want to speak a little bit about the commission and how that kind of changed the way you worked with a very specific location?
Absolutely. So in 2018, I'm going to embarrass Emma Boker over there in the back. I got invited to, I was commissioned by the FT Weekend magazine to make work in response to the My London Commission, which is an annual commission that coincides with Photo London, and it gets printed in the magazine and the supplement that's produced to coincide with the fair. And so this was the first time where I very consciously had to choose or, like, you know, decide on a specific location, because up until this point, I'd been making work which I guess in terms of the location was quite circumstantial. Like, I would travel to go home to Israel to visit my family, and I would take my camera, or I'd go to the States to visit my sister, or every time I traveled in the UK, and still do, I take my camera. So this was the first time I really had to think about why a specific location. So it was an interesting challenge, because you know, I'd been living in London for over 20 years, yet I'd never shot a single image of London. And I felt like I always had to somehow go away in order to make work. And so this was, you know, quite scary, but really exciting. And so I just thought quite a long time about where that place should be. And I was thinking again about this idea of parameters and limitations, but also something that links to, you know, the project overall, which is to try and deal with this kind of abundance of landscape images and the kind of cliches, or the, you know, the amount of images that are produced in certain sites. So for me, the Thames was one of those places that, you know, people shoot so much of. And so I thought, how can I make images that, you know, that I can abstract, but again retain something that is recognizable and relatable? But also I was thinking very specifically about the context in which the work would be shown, which was the magazine distributed in the fair. So the Thames is the longest river in England, but it's so related to, you know, when people think of the Thames, they think so much of London. So I was thinking, well, I have to, how do I focus on an area of the Thames that makes sense? And so it seemed to be obvious to think about, again, the location of the fair and the FT headquarters, which at that point was on the south bank of Southwark Bridge. So I started on the north bank near Somerset House, and then I circled it, I passed the Tate Modern, and then got to the FT, got on the boat to the Tate Britain, and shot 5 rolls of film. And the other thing that I was thinking about beyond the where they were shown in that context was the Thames as a border, as, in a way, not an invisible one, because I think it is something that we think about and cross so often as, like, Londoners. And it's something that, you know, my friends and I joke about a lot in terms of the north-south divide and how that's so important in terms of our identities as Londoners. And so that seemed quite fitting in how that was something that kind of divided us but brought us together at the same time.
And that that idea of kind of the river being a natural border, it just occurred to me that actually all of these locations are coastal or have a relationship with water. And maybe, like, coincidentally, because of the current climate and social situation, you're possibly thinking about that kind of relationship to water and what that means and what kind of barriers and separations that brings.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that I tend to get asked about is, you know, the kind of the political aspect of the work. And my answer is always that I feel like it's something that is embedded there and is definitely present and is something that I'm conscious of and I'm aware of. But it's hopefully not something that I want to be overt. Like, I want it to be a much more subtle suggestion or allusion to, you know, those kind of ideas or thinking around borders and politics. And there's also this idea of transnationalism, which, you know, kind of brings us back to this resistance to specificity, and instead kind of there's an aspiration to a greater universality, which, again, I'm always, like, aware that as much as that's the aim, that's a kind of utopian aspiration, that it's not completely possible, because I think especially because it's photography and it's indexical, there's always that kind of, you know, there's the residue or the kind of link to the real location. And I'm, you know, that's something I'm actually quite comfortable with, and it's something that I think is what I try to balance, is having something that on the one hand is recognizable and relatable, but at the same time leaves enough space for people to hopefully fill the gaps, excuse the pun.
It's interesting you say that, because I always feel like I'm intruding when I ask about the specific locations of things. Uh-huh. I always feel like I shouldn't, I should be less, that should be less important in how I think about the work. But the way that you title the work implies that actually you do want to keep it anonymous and you want it to be a no man's land.
Yeah, I think, again, there's a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I think for me the titles are a way to kind of point to that conflict or that ambivalence of, you know, on the one hand, being aware that the locations, the original locations and connotations or associations that might come about from those locations are important, but on the other hand, that there's a resistance to it. I also always say that as much as I don't want to title them with the specific locations, I completely appreciate the curiosity and the need to anchor oneself. And it's something that I'm very happy to talk about anecdotally. I just think it's very different to title something and give it a location and then to say it in conversation. But most people, I think, are curious about. And I don't mind telling people.
Mm-hmm. And do you want to explain a little bit about what the kind of coded titles are?
Yeah, so the titles of the work I made up of codes that relate back to the amount of negatives that are used for each image and the original year in which those negatives were shot. And then there's an abbreviation for the location. So in that sense, they're codes that only I know exactly what they mean. But then again, hopefully what they do is they raise questions about what those codes might mean in terms of a kind of cataloging or logging or archiving. And again, like this conflict of, on the one hand, being aware that there is this very indexical aspect to the work, and so it is important for me to retain some kind of like tie to that original location, but then just not wanting to give it away completely.
Yeah.
But there's also something just in terms of the archive that I remember you wrote about that was really interesting, was this idea of the destruction of the archive, which maybe you want to.
Yeah, it's true. I was, I think at the time when we were writing for that original publication, when you had your show at Photo Fusion, I was reading a lot of Maholi Nagy, and I was preparing for the abstraction show at Tate, and a lot of our discussions actually were around the archive. And I was fascinated with how in the history of photography, the negative is the most important thing, and we put so much emphasis on conserving it and keeping it in its kind of purest form, and you were so confident in destroying it, and it was almost scary that you would be so meticulous in keeping an archive of images with these codes and systems that you can only understand, but then at the same time you were just willing to destroy that. And I found that really fascinating.
No, that is something.
Because it's a circular process. You're destroying an archive to make a new archive.
Absolutely,
of something else.
Absolutely. And that is something that comes up a lot. I get this question from people, generally photographers, about how I feel about destroying my negatives or cutting my negatives. And I always say, well, I'm not precious about those negatives because I don't think they're very interesting, and so there's something quite liberating about using them as purely source material, and that then like also alters or shapes the way that I shoot, because when I shoot I don't have to be very precise, I can be very quick, and it's just more about getting lots of different angles which I can then reconfigure and kind of, you know, reassemble or reconfigure in the darkroom. But then, you know, if you were to ask me how I would feel about cutting the new negatives that I make, well, that's a whole other. Then I'd become very precious about them.
Wow. Okay.
So that becomes the...
Okay, that's interesting.
That's my, like, new, as you say, the new archive that is being produced, which is very precious.
Yeah. And I think there is this kind of, your work is obviously very photographic, but then it's also related to so many other things. And there's a really interesting thing about photography, and particularly photography and abstraction. I don't know if I'm going to explain this in an articulate way, but basically in every other form of art, you start with a blank canvas and you add to it. And with photography, you start with a very complicated world and you reduce it in order to make an image. And you kind of do both. And actually, in the darkroom allows you to do that, because the darkroom allows you to make something, to create something out of nothing. And particularly through the process of photograms and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I never figured out how to make something out of nothing completely, and so I think that's also why I was very drawn to photography, so starting with something that did exist, that I was kind of reacting to, and I think that's why there was always this combination of working in quite a documentary way, you know, like going out, shooting quite spontaneously, not thinking maybe as much for me in that context about what I was shooting or how I was framing. And then there was the shift into the darkroom of the studio where all of the kind of the decision making. And so, you know, it was a friend of mine who once pointed out, he said, oh, isn't it interesting that out of all of the indecision that you have originally when you're shooting in, you know, in the location, how then there's like a set of highly considered and decisive kind of moments that take place in terms of assembling or constructing these new images. And I hadn't really thought about that, but I'm quite interested in that combination and that way of working. Yeah. So something that is on the one hand quite intuitive, but then on the other hand is highly considered. And there's a lot of back and forth with that. And I think that's where also the printing in the darkroom plays a really big role, because there's things that no matter how much I think I know how certain things will behave, you know, how the negatives will react to the light when I put the negative back into the enlarger, and how when I tape something together it'll make some kind of mark or there'll be a residue, or how when I use a pen onto the negative to outline where I'm going to cut, how that will respond like to the emulsion. You know, as much as I kind of know, I never really know until I see it printed in front of me.
And, yeah, okay. there's lots of chance then.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, because there is this fascinating thing of like control and chance, which is constantly in conversation with each other. Just thinking about photography and beyond photography and how it kind of all folds into the practice. The exhibition starts when you come to the top of the stairs with a photogram of the Perspex plate that you use to make the cuts. And these kind of long drops here also are a version of a photogram of that. How strong is that? How conscious is that idea of that action being related to drawing, or is it not?
Well, it wasn't initially, and I think again that's like what I've quite enjoyed about how the project has evolved or evolved over time, is how through the process of making and like working in the darkroom, I've kind of come to realize certain things that I hadn't really thought about or considered. So, for example, that Perspex sheet that you mentioned that I used to make the photogram, that is just as you come in, the kind of one-to-one contact print on color paper, versus the kind of window drops that are made from placing the Perspex board on a flatbed scanner and then scaling it up, converting it, you know, transforming it into a black and white image. Those are all things that I never knew I would make. I mean, I used that board purely out of the necessity because I was working in the darkroom and I had a light box which I didn't want to damage, and so I found an offcut of Perspex that was lying around and I started to cut my negatives on it. And just over time, the accumulation of those incisions and those marks on that plate started to interest me in a way beyond their practical function. And so I started to think about that Perspex board more as a photographic plate in itself, as a kind of documentation of the process over time and those marks that, you know, had been made. So as a kind of record of the process and a kind of suggestion of the process in a much more abstract way than explaining to someone, you know, like how they're made. And so it just, to me, seemed like quite an interesting opportunity to use that and kind of make it into something beyond itself that then, when included in an exhibition space, in a show, started to do something very different to the other work and kind of hopefully expanded it beyond the kind of photographic, as you say. And also, like, the mark, how, you know, I'm quite interested in how things aren't necessarily what they seem, so that might, people might think it's a drawing, or, and then the photogram, another nice kind of serendipitous moment was when I saw that the print came out, like the kind of mark came out, these kind of orangey, they just had this kind of flare, and I thought, isn't that interesting how they start to speak with the flares in the larger pieces? And how there's a direct correlation between that cut, which is being recorded, versus the cut that, you know, is scaled up in the kind of larger pieces.
Yeah, and unexpected as well.
Yeah.
And how important is that? So how many versions of the photogram have you done?
Three.
This is the third iteration.
Yeah.
And how important is that one-to-one scale versus the rest of the works in the room that are scaled up and now have much more of a relationship to painting, actually?
Well, I think that's what I mean, is having that range. And I think scale generally is something that I think about a lot. And actually, especially in relation to this exhibition, Sid and I spent a long time talking about and thinking about the scale for each, you know, like all of this work was newly produced for this show, so it had never been scaled up. It only existed, you know, as a negative and a small print. I always make folio prints as my kind of master prints before I decide how to scale them up. And so it was really important to think about how they functioned in different ways in relation to their scale and in relation to each other. So I think that's something that just kind of runs, and there's something about, again, the window drops and how those marks get scaled up in a very different way, and also kind of then speak about that more generally in relation to the work that is being made. Mm-hmm.
And those folio prints you mentioned, so are they similar to the three small works in the frame at the back?
So there's one, so we produced a limited edition folio, and for the folios I've made two different prints that come with an essay that was written by Duncan Wooldridge. And again, we were thinking very much about scale, because we realized that as soon as we decide, we kind of choose that image becomes the edition, it's an edition of 70. We were kind of sacrificing scaling it up as an exhibition print, because that's something that, you know, we were thinking about, like, these are all editions of 5, and then all of a sudden you have a much larger edition. And so there were those two pieces that I had done a slightly bigger version of in the darkroom, and I felt that something got lost. It just didn't work on a larger scale, and so they seemed like the ideal candidates for the folio. And so the triptych that you see on the back wall that you're referring to, those are a set of studies, which are the studies that I make before I reach the fine. So because, as I was saying, the printing is such an important part of making the work, then inevitably before I reach the final image, there's like a set of studies that I have to make before I decide that I've arrived at the kind of final destination. And so I started to incorporate some of those studies and to show them in the context of the exhibition a couple of years ago, because I thought there was something interesting about that repetition and the variation, and how those pieces did something very different to the larger and pieces, and how they alluded to the process, again, and hopefully in an interesting way without being reductive or giving too much away. So the general, if we're coming back to rules, then the general rule is that whenever I show studies in an exhibition, I don't show them in the same space as the final image, because what I really want to avoid is this reductive kind of illustrative, these make this. Again, it's not something I mind talking about, like, you know, in person, but in an exhibition space, I think it flattens something.
Yeah, and this idea of kind of restrictions and rules, and also this idea of codes that comes into your work. We were talking earlier, and I haven't quite figured it out yet, and I was thinking it's going to be really interesting in retrospect in 10 or 20 years' time for someone to look at the evolution of this body of work and to think about what those kind of codes and limitations, how they have steered it. I still don't quite have my head around it yet.
I don't have a theory. Yeah. I don't have a theory either. I just think it's my obsessive nature. That's my theory so far.
We have spoken in the past about kind of the different colour palette of the colour printing. Particularly in this show, things seem very cohesive, actually. Maybe more so than the groups of works you've shown before.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's because I made this work very consciously, you know, for this exhibition. I mean, usually in previous cases, you know, like in a group show, I'll show a couple of pieces, maybe three pieces maximum, and they're in the context of other work, and it's, you know, a lot of times it might be existing work, whereas this was, you know, made specifically for this space and for this show, obviously thinking also beyond its kind of, you know, its original context here and how it might then, you know, exist beyond this space. But there was something about the selection of work when we were thinking about it as a collection of images, and then very much thinking again, as I was saying earlier, about the scale and how, and the amount of space that we left around certain pieces, or, you know, less space, because, and so how they kind of relate to each other. But then also, I think I mentioned to you earlier how, even though some are made very much from the same material, so for example, these three were all made from the same roll of film, from the same location.
And you've hung it here like it's a triptych, and it's a kind of group within the group.
Absolutely, there's a kind of cluster. And actually, when it came to the curation of the show, we started from the corner. So this was the kind of the starting point, and then we kind of worked our way out. And then there's also, in terms of the continuity of the palette, is because there's a certain economy which I tend to adhere to when I make the work, which is that I start one, and I use, let's say, I don't know, a certain amount of negatives, and then anything that's left over, all the remnants from that piece, get used to make the next one, and then the next one. And so things get added, but then kind of like you start something else, and then,
yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And the kind of challenge there is to waste as little as possible, but then also to make something again that is more cohesive and kind of sits together within the larger body of work.
Okay, I didn't know that, so that's fascinating.
Yeah, and actually sometimes so for this show specifically, I was very conscious of, you know, the different formats or shapes, because that's something that you, I think, raised as well in your essay originally, was the freedom that I have to construct the, you know, like...
The photographic frame doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly.
The restrictions of the size of the negative don't
exist.
Yeah,
absolutely. So for this show, with this piece, I was very... I just thought I really wanted to produce something that was panoramic.
Yeah.
And so that informed the elements and like the way that I built that negative. And then I thought, well, now I have a panoramic one, I want to make something that is more square. And so again, how they kind of, you know, complemented each other in terms of those formats. So yeah, that's also. But then sometimes I just start to build a negative and I see where it takes me and I have no idea what shape it will be.
And in that way, really related to sculpture, actually.
Mm.
Yeah. I'm going to see if anyone else has questions they would like to ask Daphne. Hello.
Sorry, I got in a little late, so I don't know if you have a question on negative space. But all because thinking about the early pieces from the series, they're, you know, much tighter compositions that actually still read as images.
Yeah.
And then later on, it became a lot more fragmented, and this negative space started creeping in. Looking at the smaller piece behind you, like the negative space, like black squiggle, and it becomes the defining compositional feature.
Yeah.
So I just wondered if you could talk a little about how, you know, negative space in these like became a thing, whether you were actually conscious of it, and then set us explore further how this transition.
Yeah. That's a really interesting question. I think the transition from the earlier work to the more current work, where I was talking about how initially it was two negatives that were combined and only one element was cut out, so the kind of collaging was much more straightforward. I was very aware of that void or that black space, or that, and but actually conceptually, even though it reads the same, like there's, because they're black voids on paper, actually conceptually they're very different, because in the earlier work, that black void is actually obstructing something that actually, like, that there is a landscape that is being obstructed, because it's, there's another layer. Whereas here, the voids are very different because they are blank space. And so, but saying that, I feel like visually they function in a similar way, because what I hope they do is that on the one hand, they're obstructions, they kind of block something, but then they're openings at the same time. That other, so hopefully there's like a push and pull that happens. And those, and then those black spaces also function in the sense that I think sometimes they start to be read more as elements of landscape in themselves. They might be misconstrued as that. And I think that's maybe to do with the fact that there's an attempt to, as you said, to like piece it together or kind of make it up into a recognizable image, something that is more representational, because these are, as you said, much more abstracted in that sense. But I think, you know, I think also they do function quite differently. I mean, there's that one which is also, I think, can be read more traditionally in, you know, in terms of representation and in terms of like following certain pictorial conventions. So that's something hopefully that I play with, that each one has its own kind of set of not rules, but again, like, that it somehow does something different from the other. So it's hard to give a kind of, like, straight answer in terms of the differences, because hopefully the differences are kind of more varied than that, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And how, this is a little bit kind of off topic, but I seem to have this kind of idea that there's an apocalyptic sense in them as well, which may or may not be true. How does that idea of black and negative space and empty space, does that play into that at all?
Not consciously. But I think that's what I really like, you know. I feel like when you put work out in the world, like, it takes on, like, there's things that, you know, that are there as your intentions or things that you think about as an artist when you're making work, either before or as or in retrospect. But then there's all the things that, like, people bring to the work, which I, A, don't have control over, and B, is quite interesting because, you know, it kind of just opens it up in a way that could, you know, could be quite narrow otherwise. So I'm very open to other people's interpretations and apocalyptic readings.
Yes. Are there any other questions? Yeah? Yeah.
I had a question. Well, I'm thinking sort of as you were talking about the colour palette and colour printing and how all sort of different tones come from the printing.
Mm.
But actually, Trey, just kind of followed my train of thought a bit on picking up on the black space, because I was wondering that most of, well, a lot of your work process is actually in negative, sort of, so it's not a black space, it's the white space. And so I was wondering how much of your process is kind of imagining things in the sort of ultimate, like, positive colour space, and how much of it, when you're sort of in the process of cutting things up and sort of working with those sort of shapes and reverse colours, sort of, well, I don't really, I've not got a formulated question, but...
No, that's a really interesting point. I think there's a lot of imagining that takes place, and I think that's, again, what I really enjoy about the process, that I just, as much as I've been doing this for such a long time, I still never really know, like, how things will react. And so actually, like, going back to this idea of the kind of negative space and where there isn't a negative, that obviously has an impact when you put that back into the enlarger and how the light bounces around and how it flares or doesn't flare is something that varies quite a lot depending on the size of the gap between the pieces. And how, again, so then the color printing is such an intrinsic part in the sense of trying to get to a certain color balance or kind of like neutrality, so-called neutrality. But, you know, like, at the same time being aware that that's impossible because of that kind of flaring or the kind of color casts that occur as a result of the bouncing of the light in these, like, small spaces that then obviously get scaled up. And that's actually something that the printer that I work with, so I produce all the small prints, the original prints, in my darkroom, but then when I have an exhibition, I've been working very closely with the same printer for about 10 years. His name is Brian O'Leary, and Artful Dodgers Imaging, just giving them a shout out. He's brilliant, so we work very closely together, and it's something that we talk about a lot, because obviously when I print something at this scale, a small scale in the darkroom, I get certain flares and certain kind of, you know, then it has an impact on the color palette. But then when we scale it up and there's, like, different chemistry and different paper, then inevitably you can't get an exact replica. And so it becomes, you know, a conversation about where you make those decisions, like, and then where you might lose something, but you gain something else.
Yeah. Any final thoughts? I have actually one more question, sorry. previously you had white borders around things. I was just thinking about this exhibition in particular, And it seems really resolved, actually. So congratulations.
Thank
it feels
you.
Like it's gotten to a point of display that is really resolved. And I was just thinking about those white borders and how now they're kind of not really present.
Mm.
And that feels like another step in this process. Is that correct?
Definitely. I mean, that's the thing that, again, we thought a lot about in terms of this exhibition and the work and, you know, different framing options, which is something I tend to struggle with quite a lot. I've tried lots of different things.
Yeah.
And the white borders, I guess at one point I felt they were important because the images are really dense and I felt they really needed that breathing space. But then in a practical sense, when I scaled up to a certain size, then it became quite difficult. We had to produce masks for the borders, the white borders, and so it became like really expensive or just not doable. And so then there were certain images that didn't have the white borders and some that did. And I think just at this point, all of a sudden we thought, yeah, don't really need the white borders anymore, and actually like framing them differently also. We just thought a lot more about the wood finish and this kind of tray frame that I hadn't quite used before. Yeah, really happy with the frames that were made. Another shout out, if that's okay. Jack Carvoso Studio, who sits in the Penar Center, so just that way. He's brilliant. And, you know, so again, we spent quite a lot of time with him, with the prints, and, you know, with, like, different tints and really thinking about something that would work across the range of, because there are images that, you know, the palette, although it seems quite cohesive, when it comes to it, the subtleties, the nuances are quite different.
Yeah. I think you can really tell that this has been evolving for 10 years and it's at a point now which really feels cohesive. So well done and congratulations
on the
show.
Thank you.